we plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this woman, not traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other would both get value from the episode.
So one of the things that I've been doing this week is interviewing doctoral students for placements in our clinic next year. And it's been really interesting to have these interviews and really, as anyone who's hiring or is making decisions about someone based on a 30 or 60 minute interaction, you're making all of these kind of snap judgments, or you're using all of your resources to try to perceive, like, what kind of person is this? Do I like them? Are they good to work with? And I'm kind of having fun in my mind unpacking what I'm observing and why I think what I think. One of the things that I really pay a lot of attention to, especially for clinical psychologists, is to watch how people manage anxiety in the room. You know, it's a pretty inherently anxiety-provoking process, especially for these folks, most of whom are early on in their doctoral training. So they've done a lot with their lives, but many of them are kind of early 20s and are still getting established as professionals. So for many, it's a pretty anxiety-provoking experience to have an interview and have this kind of conversation. So I get to watch them work through that kind of right in front of me. And that actually is super helpful because it tells me a lot about how they'll handle their own anxiety when they're in the room with a patient or with a client. And so I'm looking a lot at nonverbal cues and how someone holds their body and whether they take a couple breaths if their voice begins to quiver and how they sit in the chair across from me. And so there's a lot of things that I'm paying attention to about how they're coping with an anxiety-provoking situation. But it's got me thinking a lot about how all of us make these first impressions or how we are working to handle the emotional content of an interaction or kind of handle the emotional presence in the room. And I thought that might be interesting to talk about with you. I know you've done a lot of hiring and obviously speaking and having selecting speakers for MicroComp. So there's a lot that you do to sort of assess someone's characteristics and kind of their ability to handle hard things in a brief interview.
Yeah, for sure. I've done a lot of phone interviews. I think I've done hundreds of phone interviews, literally, because we used to go through a lot of candidates down at a company I worked at in LA. And then I would guess close to 100, if not more than that, kind of in-person or, you know, video Skype interviews. And I think that at first, when I used to do interviews, I was nervous, right? It was like new scenario and new situation. And my anxiety would ramp up like, do I need to make this person feel okay? Why do I feel so out of control? What am I going to say next? What if I say something stupid as the interviewer? You know, this is a decade ago or more. But I think that the more I've been on both sides of the chair, in essence, or both sides of the table, especially on the interviewer side, it's made me realize certain things that people will do or say or how they'll act. And it's kind of made me adopt the ones where I'm like, oh, this person actually looked calm and in control and had charisma. And it's because they felt like this and they did these things. And it helped, I think, drive that in myself because I realized that I wanted to look more calm and more confident. And as you said, you know, vetting people for MicroConf is part of that. But to be honest, just being up on stage in general, the first several times you do it is terrifying. And you do all the things that everyone else does that makes you seem nervous. You know, your voice changes and you pace around and your voice is shaky and you don't make eye contact well enough and you talk too fast or too slow or something. And then over time, as you develop, that can improve. And that's when you have like stage presence, you know, and that's when you see the people who kind of command the stage and you're like, what are they doing differently? And it's like, huh, they're just talking normally. You know, they're not giving off all these nervous signs. And I feel like that's in an interview can be part of it as well, as like just not giving off all the signs of rampant anxiety, even if they are nervous, but it's controlling them and just having, you know, like presence in the room.
I think I talked about this in one of my MicroConf talks, but there's so much data to suggest that emotion is really contagious. And so the person who comes in the room and is sort of owning the emotional quality of the room is kind of the power player. So when you're up on stage or you're giving a talk and you are genuinely breathing and kind of calm inside of yourself, then that gets communicated to everyone else. And when you're nervous and your voice is quivering and you're shaking and you're sort of fumbling with your slides, that kind of anxiety, even if it's subtle, gets sort of transferred to everyone else in the room. And so rather than like sitting back and enjoying your thoughtful and interesting presentation, they're feeling anxious along with you. And so the more that you can control the emotion that you feel in your own body and then be aware of how you're communicating that to others, I think the more kind of superpower you have to be present and to communicate the kind of emotional sort of intelligence and reciprocity that you want to when you're in one of these kind of higher anxiety or higher stakes interactions.
Yeah, I think, you know, most humans are empathetic. And when you see someone up on stage really, really sweating it and not doing well, you feel bad for them, right? And if they're
hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, most people do.
If you're not empathetic, that's a different problem.
Right. And if you see someone up there just, you know, just killing it and really knocking it out of the park, you almost don't even realize it because you're so enraptured by what they're saying. You don't have to be empathetic and be like, wow, they're really killing it. So therefore I feel like I'm killing it too. But if they're killing it, you're just wrapped up in the presentation and there's no distraction.
Well, at least you're having a positive emotion.
Yeah.
If the person on stage is having a positive emotion, you're having a positive emotion too.
If you're in that job interview, or if you're at a team meeting and you're leading a team of 10 people or 20 people, or if you're up on stage at a conference, the positive, like if you truly are exuding positive energy and you're actually leading in essence, or you're kind of leading the room, like you said, it's running the room, right? Then that's contagious with people. And there's subtle ways of doing it to where you don't come off like some type of cheerleader or something where people don't take you seriously. But I think this has a lot to do with both being an interviewee, public speaking, and being a founder and leading a group of people.
I think you've just offended like generations of cheerleaders.
No, I didn't mean,
by the way,
that's what I meant. I genuinely didn't mean to do that, but I just mean somebody, you don't want to feel like someone's kind of rah-rahing you for their own benefit or just because they're, I don't know, because it's like they want to get more productivity out of you or something. It's like you want to feel like someone genuinely cares and is delivering this message that is genuine to them and like it's not out of character. Because it's, you know what I think it is? Like when I see someone speak on stage, if they're really nervous, then it's distracting from the presentation. And if I feel like someone is not being genuine or not being themselves, it's distracting because I'm caught up with like, they wouldn't normally say that, or they don't normally sound like that. Like, I think that's probably a piece of it, is like authenticity.
Yeah. One of the powerful things at play here are mirror neurons. And these are like fascinating parts of our brain where we observe someone else doing something or feeling something. And those very same parts of our brains light up or are activated, even if we're not doing that. So one of the examples that I use when I talk about this in classes is I'll stand on one foot and just work on my body is balancing. My sensory motor cortex is activated and is trying to figure out how to hold my body up on one foot. But as others observe that posture in me, they are having the exact same experience. Their brains are working on balancing too, even though they're sitting in their chairs. So what we are doing or feeling, other people at purely a neurological, unconscious, non-cognitive level, they're with us and they are having the same neurological experience, whether or not they're having the same physical or emotional experience.
I think this is all involved in charisma. There's a book I read, and I don't remember if it was called The Charisma Myth or How to Have Charisma or something like that, but it was a researcher who had studied charisma and what it is and how people have it and why they have it. And in essence, boil it down to these three factors. The first one is warmth. Second one is power. And the third was presence. And the warmth is making someone feel like you're relating to them and like you're a nice person and you genuinely care about them. The power was if you have power in a situation or you are a powerful person in general or just situationally. And then the third was presence. And it means like focusing on the conversation, not being distracted, not looking over their shoulder, looking at someone else and really interacting with them. And I think those three things, you know, you may not have power in a job interview when you're being interviewed, but you can definitely have warmth and presence. And I think reducing your anxiety, like you said, is something that helps with that because it's not contagious. And I think the warmer you are and the more kind of an engagement you have can honestly like edges you in and can give you some power in the interview if you really do act like, look, I know that I'm qualified for this job and I'm actually interviewing you as much as you are of me. That's just like one example. But I remember when I used to go around, once you're a senior software developer, like everybody wants to hire you. And I remember going in and saying, look, I have questions for you because I do have multiple options and I really want to make sure that the fit is a good mutual fit. And that actually can give you a little bit of power even when you're being interviewed for a job.
Especially if you ask really good questions, right? They're really thoughtful questions and there's some content behind it. You're not just dropping the statement of like, I'm interviewing you because I'm a badass, but you're really clearly putting a lot of energy into deciding whether the fit is right for you. This issue of warmth, I think, is really interesting. I read a study or heard about a study. I think it was maybe in Amy Cuddy's book, Presence, which I'll talk about more in a minute. But she talked about a study that they showed snippets of physicians interacting with their patients for like a minute. It was a pretty short snippet. And then they asked people, based on watching this video, to rate how likely that physician was to be sued throughout their career. And the people were incredibly accurate, like based on being able to judge the warmth of the physician. So warmth predicts the likelihood of getting sued, but people could read warmth really accurately based on a very, very minimal amount of time observing the physician with a patient, which I just think is really fascinating. The extent to which you communicate warmth, like I'm emotionally available, I'm interested, I'm paying attention, I'm genuinely glad to see you. When you can communicate those things, you really create, I think, a lot of power for yourself and you create a sense of being trustworthy and attractive, and all kinds of things go into when you are communicating a sense of warmth to other people.
You know, and one example of warmth that I can think of that I'm not sure that I was good at, let's say the very first year that we hosted MicroConf, is to start thinking like that I'm actually hosting people, that they're like there coming to your house. And after I'd listened to this book, I realized, oh, when I'm hosting MicroConf, of course, I just, by definition, I have some power, right? And if I can then have warmth and presence, then I can achieve this thing where people feel really welcome and it's a fun time. And one aspect of warmth that I'm not sure I pulled off early, but later on have started doing is I am genuinely, you know, interested in people when I see them and trying to remember their names and trying to remember what they're up to and introducing them to other people and not just be, I think, deer in the headlights like the first year. I mean, actually, I went to a different conference it was about 6 months ago. And there was a dude who I'd followed for a while. And I came up to him and said, hey, and he was hosting the conference as well. And I just kind of told him, hey, I've been a follower and was it through this membership website that you ran and stuff. And he was totally deer in the headlights. And I'm not sure if he was overwhelmed. It was like his first conference or whatever, but I did not feel any warmth from him. And I don't think it's because he's a mean person or anything, but I walked away feeling kind of like, oh, that was just an odd interaction. And I think that being deliberate about that and kind of gearing up for it mentally when you're going into a stressful situation, whether it's hosting a conference, whether it's speaking on stage, whether it's doing a job interview, being interviewed, you know, any of these things where you are going to be evaluated by people and it's stressful or anxiety provoking, I think having a very deliberate mindset about kind of exuding this warmth and presence, I think is a learned skill over time, but I think it's critical to kind of growing as a person in your presence.
That makes me want to circle back around to Amy Cuddy's book. It's called Presence. And she's a social psychologist in the business school at Harvard. And she also has a TED talk called something like How Body Language Rules the World or something to that effect. But she writes a lot about how nonverbal cues communicate both to others and to oneself. And so this whole conversation about how do you come across to other people? Do you appear warm? Do you appear powerful? Do you appear present? Do you appear tuned in? A great deal of that has to do with how we hold our bodies and how we manage the space that we take up in the world. So obviously you can think kind of from an animal perspective, when we want to show power, we get tall, we stand up straight, we might put our arms up. There's this expression of power where you're taking up size and occupying a lot of space in the room. And then when we're being demure or timid or fearful, many of us will kind of make ourselves small. We'll hunch over, we'll cross our arms in front of our chest, we cross our legs, we take up much less space. And so she's really interested in how not only do those kinds of postures communicate to other people, but how we can kind of hack the presence game by practicing those physical postures ourselves and changing our own internal experience of how we feel. I know that sounds super weird, but basically if you force yourself to smile, it actually improves your mood. So if you like put a pen in your mouth that forces the corners of your mouth to go up and your teeth to sort of be present, your lips to roll back from your teeth, it's like this totally fake smile. People report that they actually feel better. They feel happier. So practicing these kind of forced presence or forced body postures can increase our internal sense of power, whether or not we are walking into a job interview, putting our feet up on the desk and say, look, sir, I'm actually interviewing you. We don't have to do that kind of nonsense. But practicing presence and power in our bodies can be super helpful.
And so talk about some more ways to do that, because I think that like more specifics of how someone could perhaps get better at this might be helpful.
So some of the specific body postures that she talks about, these aren't surprising. They're standing with your shoulders broad and down away from your ears, your shoulder blades kind of pulled down your back. So you're standing at sort of your maximum height and your arms relaxed down at your sides. Or another big kind of power posture is to do like the Superman style, where you have your arms up over your head, kind of like you're flying. It sounds a little bit silly, but if you stand like that, where your arms are outstretched away from your toes, you, again, are taking up a lot of space in the world. You're at your maximum surface area. So it's a stance that's very open and very muscularly engaged and super powerful. So she recommends like doing that in the bathroom before a job interview. And then when you sit down for a job interview or before you give a talk, not hunch over your smartphone and sort of make yourself small and let your shoulders fold in, but sit up really straight, loop your elbow on the chair next to you, have your shoulders really wide, sit up really straight or stand up tall, and not hunch and not get small, especially before you're going on stage or going into an interview.
And I think the first time you do it will probably feel unnatural, because I think a lot of us are used to doing that, whether we just have bad posture or it's the natural reaction to the psychological or physiological reaction is to make yourself small. And so I don't think you want to, I think if you walk out and you're all awkward and stiff, it's going to look unnatural. But that's where I think a little bit of practice in the mirror to be like, huh, what part of this looks good and what part of it doesn't? And I think this could be something helpful.
I think the bottom line is that our minds and our bodies are really integrated. So our minds can change our bodies. When we're anxious, we feel that in our bodies. When we're proud, we feel that in our bodies. But our bodies can also change our minds. So when we hold ourselves in certain kinds of postures, that changes the emotional state of our mind, or it can even change the kinds of beliefs that we have about ourselves. According to some of Amy Cuddy's research, it can even change our risk tolerance. So our minds change our bodies change our minds. And who we are and how we feel about ourselves determines how other people read us and see us and interpret us.
And I think coming back to the forced smile thing that you said about how smiling actually can make you happier and raise your mood, I've read that in a number of books. And I think that it's something that folks can come back to when you do feel like crap. There's a bunch of different exercises I do, one of which is to, who did I take this from? Oh man, I forget what book it is. But basically the person said, when I start to feel really crappy, I ask myself these questions. And I think it was the book about A More Beautiful Question. I think that's what it was called. And he says, ask yourself, what would a confident optimist do in this situation? And I love the framing of that is you're not saying, what would I do if I were a confident optimist? You're saying, what would a, you know, so think of a confident optimist and then do that. And that mindset, that mind shift, I don't know, it can have an impact on you if you take it really seriously and you actually say, I feel anxious or I feel scared or I'm uncertain right now, but what would a person who is actually thinking clearly do right now. And I think that I've felt it like completely elevate me and make me think at a higher level and make me think just more clearly and have kind of more positive thoughts and more rational thoughts rather than having anxiety about the decision I'm making. And I think looping it back into this forced smile thing, I think that's another way of kind of tricking yourself. It's like you said, your mind changes your body changes your mind, and getting in this upward posture, stretching, doing a tiny bit of exercise, some push-ups. I mean, these are all things that I try to do when I'm feeling uncertain or crappy or anxious or whatever, and preparing for something that I think is going to be pretty difficult.
I think in past episodes, I've talked a little bit about some of the work that I'm really interested in and how we use yoga or body-based stretching to help people with anxiety disorders or with trauma-related problems. And one of the things that I will often do in my relaxation groups, or even if I'm in an individual session with someone who's really struggling, is, you know, we kind of talk through the feelings and get the tears out and those kinds of things, which are super important to do, obviously, in therapy. But then I might ask someone to stand in a really powerful yoga pose, like a mountain pose or even a warrior pose, something where their body is really open, and I ask them to breathe. And I think those kinds of experiences are really powerful. So whether or not you're forcing a smile or you just find a quiet corner and just practice holding your body in a different kind of way or a powerful way, or whether you do a little warrior yoga sequence before having a difficult conversation or doing an interview or something like that. So these are some simple strategies that I think can be life hacks to help you think about the way that you run the emotional room around you, or to help you think about how to be warm and powerful and present in all kinds of situations, tough ones and easy ones, but really understanding the role that your mind and body play in how you communicate who you are to other people.
And I think this is critical, whether you're starting with the example that you did of basically coming in for a job or an internship interview. I think it's important when you're leading a team as a founder or a manager, when you're up on stage, when you're doing a video interview. I can even imagine doing audio, like a podcast interview. If you're nervous about that, strike in the pose and get in the smile. And I think that that can help you basically perform better anytime that you're being presented in any way to an audience where, you know, you care about their reaction.
Are we legally allowed to play Madonna's Vogue as the outro for this episode?
I mean, some people do it and say they use it under Creative Commons. I think technically it's not really allowed because it's not under Creative Commons. And yeah.
Strike a pose.
Yep. If you feel like you get value from this podcast and you want to help support the show and help us improve it, head over to supportzenfounder.com and you can pledge a one-time amount, or like all of our patrons have done to date, pledge a couple bucks, $2, $3, $5 a month goes a long way. It's helped us improve the show already. I'm sure you've noticed the new theme music that was put together by our editor, who were able to pay with funds from the Patreon. So supportzenfounder.com if you'd like to help improve the show.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.